Jesus will give, Jesus will give, He will uphold and sustain.
The last week of the life of the Lord occupies a very prominent position in the gospel records. One third of Matthew and Mark are occupied with the last week of the Lord's life. And one fourth of the Gospel of Luke is taken up exclusively with that one week. And then one half of John is occupied with the last week of the Lord's life. Matthew begins in chapter 21, Mark in chapter 11, Luke in chapter 19, and then John begins that last week recorded in John the 12th chapter. And we're going to use these four accounts tonight to establish a background in which to view the last 18 hours of his life for the next 4 or 5 weeks during the next few weeks that we're together here during the summer session. The records in Mark and Luke we're going to use as the chronological record. Matthew is involved primarily in the teaching that Jesus Christ did to the outsiders. And John's gospel is involved exclusively with the great discourse that Jesus gave to his disciples in John 13 through 17. And in this background, we're going to use this material tonight from Matthew and Mark and Luke and John to give you an account and a background of the last 18 hours of the Lord's life, and we'll concentrate on that for the following few weeks. The year of the Lord's death was, according to the Jewish calendar, year number 3790 from the creation. People from all over the whole world were streaming into Jerusalem, beginning their journeys from Parthia and Media and dwellers from Mesopotamia and Cappadocia and all over the world, from both the eastern and the western and the southern dispersion of the Jewish people. And the entire Mediterranean area began every year to come alive as these people, these pilgrims, made their way and began their preparations, gathered their belongings together, took ships, caravans, donkeys, horses, whatever may have been the mode of travel most appropriate. They began to make this joyful pilgrimage back to the city of Jerusalem for the Passover feast. And Jesus and his disciples were among those estimated 2,700,000 people, can you imagine it, who assembled in the city of Jerusalem on that year, on that day, or during that feast day of the year, 3,790. Josephus estimates that there were 2,700,000 people who participated in the feast that year. Jesus and his disciples were among those people who, throughout Judea and Galilee, made their way up to the city of Jerusalem in their family caravans, or families would band together and would then go together for protection to keep themselves protected from robbers and bands of renegades. And Jesus was found among those people, and they must have been a joyful group of people that made their way up to Jerusalem each year for that great feast that had been so many, many years in observance. And so Jesus and his disciples were on their way as they came from one place to another. Mark, in the 9th chapter of Mark, begins by recording that the Lord was up in the area of Mount Hermon. That's way on up some 40 or 50 miles north of the Sea of Galilee, and that they made their way down from the Mount Hermon area, came on into Galilee, into the area of Galilee proper. And then Mark also in the 9th chapter says that they came to Capernaum, and Jesus went into the house. Whether this was his house, I don't know. He was either renting it or someone had graciously allowed him to use it. Perhaps it was Simon Peter's house. Peter lived in Capernaum, and his mother-in-law and his family lived there. Perhaps that was the house. But nevertheless, Mark records that they made their way through Galilee, came to Capernaum, On the way there, the disciples were found to be arguing among themselves about who was the greatest among them. And Jesus asked them about it when they got into the house, and they refused to tell him because they were afraid and ashamed. Mark records then that they left Capernaum and went on into Jericho. And he records there the great meeting with blind Bartimaeus, and one of the other accounts records that there was a friend of Bartimaeus's who was also blind, and Jesus healed these men. Coming on then through the main street of probably of Jericho, he met the man Zacchaeus and told him to come on down from the tree, that he was going to go home with him that day for dinner, and he was going to spend the day with him. And Mark records that. Luke records it in the 19th chapter, rather. And record these beautiful events, these men giving these the background material of the life of Jesus as he begins to make this final approach to the city of Jerusalem. But they came over to what Mark records as the area east of the Jordan River. And he stayed there for a while. I got this chronology a bit reversed. He didn't come to Jericho yet. Let's back him up just a ways. He came across the Jordan River to an area that is called the wilderness area where John had been baptizing. And he stayed there for a while, and more or less in seclusion. I think probably that it was while he was there that he heard the news about his friend Lazarus's death. And it was from there that he left and made an unexpected visit back into Judea, and then left after he had raised Lazarus from the dead and went into the little town called Ephraim, north, almost due north of Jericho, near the Jordan River at the area of the wilderness, or at the edge of the wilderness. And there he stayed for a few days, and then after only a few days, he left and made his way south to the city of Jericho. And there's where he met Bartimaeus and healed him of his blindness. That's where he met Zacchaeus and went home with him and spent the day. And then they went on up to the city of Jerusalem, which isn't very far, but it's almost straight up due west and almost due north, straight up. It's that steep. But they made their way on there to the city of Bethany. Matthew, Mark, and Luke do not record the time spent in Bethany. They record it as though Jesus went directly from Jericho into the city of Jerusalem in his triumphal entry. But John inserts this week that Jesus enjoyed there in the company of his friends. He probably arrived in Bethany on Friday afternoon. At least he arrived there by Saturday. And because of the regulations for regarding travel on the Sabbath, I suspect that Jesus arrived there on a Friday afternoon, spent the night with Mary and Martha and Lazarus. The next day, Simon the leper, a man whom Jesus had healed, and Lazarus, the man whom Jesus had raised from the dead, and Mary and Martha and some of their other cronies, their friends, they all got together and gave Jesus a special feast. And it was during this feast that Mary, the sister of Martha, came in with this pound of pure nard ointment and anointed the Lord's head, and it filled the aroma, John says, filled the whole house. It must have been a very beautiful smell or scent that came from this pure nard, this pound of it. It was then that Judas condemned Mary for doing this, and it was then that Jesus said, "Leave her alone. She's done a very beautiful thing to me." That took place on Saturday. Then that night, they spent the night probably there in Bethany. The next morning begins the events of the last week of the Lord's life. And I want you to go with me now for a few moments. Let's join the company of Jesus' disciples, and let's spend just a few moments with Jesus during the last week of his life before he was crucified. Sunday, the major event that took place on Sunday was the triumphal entry. That next morning, on Sunday morning, Jesus sent John and some of his disciples to go and find a young ass, a young donkey, as we would call it, and secured the services of that beast for his triumphal entry. We don't know exactly what time of day it was. It may have been afternoon, because of the simple fact that after their entry into the Jerusalem, there wasn't much time left at the end of the day. But nevertheless, the men went and found the young animal. Jesus sat upon it, and they began to make their way into the city of Jerusalem. On their way, people got the news that Jesus of Nazareth was coming. A whole group of people who had seen Lazarus raised from the dead, They came out of the city of Jerusalem and met him halfway. And all this great crowd of people began to come. The enthusiasm began to build up. The children began to cry out, Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. And the old Pharisees and scribes said, don't you hear what these are saying? Stop them. Jesus said, I tell you, if you were to stop these children, the very stones themselves would cry out. And then he quoted a prophecy out of the Old Testament, or a proverb, that out of the mouth of babes and sucklings thou hast perfected praise. But as the enthusiasm began to build, you might think that this Jesus would be coming in for a very great and joyous occasion. But as you read the records, you find that instead of that, he stopped the procession and he stood there and looked out over the city of Jerusalem and he began to cry. It says he began to weep. It isn't an uncontrolled crying. This word means a very soft, genuine, but personal sobbing, a distraught feeling of sorrow. And he began to weep over the city of Jerusalem, crying out, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that stones the prophets and kills those that are sent unto thee. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not. He began to cry over the great loss that the city of Jerusalem had suffered. When he went on into the city of Jerusalem, he went to the temple. He entered by the east gate anyway. Now, at the time that Jesus lived, the great golden gate of the temple was still open. Some 600 years later, it was closed by the edict of one of the Arab sultans, or the Turkish sultans. The east gate still remains closed. The golden gate, you can see it today, is still blocked up. It was open at the time that Jesus Christ entered, and it was through that gate that he entered. And there's a whole world of information on that would thrill your heart that we'll not have time to go into tonight. But he entered in through the golden gate. The temple area was immediately inside the golden gate. And he came into the temple, and there it says, as Mark records it, he looked around on all that was going on, and that included the selling of the oxen or the sheep and the lambs and all the rest that was going on in the city, in the temple there. And it says, but because it was late, he didn't do anything. He just looked around and more or less cased the joint and then left and went back out to Bethany where he was spending the night. I suspect that Bethany was the nearest place that he could find accommodations. Had it not been for the fact that Mary and Martha and Lazarus were there and Simon the leper, Jesus would have had to have sought accommodations. You know how it is when there is a lectureship around here. Well, people come here for the lectureship, but they go back to Ball Knob and down to BB and other places where there are accommodations. That was the same or similar thing that Jesus no doubt had to do on that particular Sunday evening. On the next morning, however, he came into the city of Jerusalem, and it seemed that the first order of business that he had was to clean out the temple. Now, I don't know how long it took to clean a temple, but it must have taken a good while. But he drove out those people. He made a scourge of cords, and you know the story, how he drove these people out, drove the animals out, turned over the tables of the money changers, and said, get out of here. You're not going to make my father's house a house of robbers or a den of thieves. It's to be a house of prayer for all the nations. And he drove the people out and tried to restore some order to that chaotic picture that he found there in the temple of his father. And then we don't have much more of a record of what happened on that Monday, except that it simply says that he went out of there and went back out to Bethany, went back to his hotel or his motel or the home where he was staying. He spent the night there again. Tuesday then, early Tuesday morning, he got up and went back into the city of Jerusalem, back into the temple, and he began to teach. And that's when the fireworks began. The scribes and the Pharisees pounced upon him as he was teaching. They opened up this barrage, and they said, tell us, by what authority have you done all of this, and who gave you this authority? And they were very belligerent. And if you'll read between the lines, you'll see they were just bristling because he had invaded their territory. And they said, I want to know who gave you this authority, and by what authority have you done what you've done? And then Jesus answers them very shrewdly and very wisely. He said, well, let me ask you a question. And if you'll answer my question, then I'll answer your question. He said, the baptism of John, was it from heaven or from men? Well, they got together in a huddle and said, now, if we say it's from heaven, he's going to say, well, why didn't you do it? Why didn't you obey him? But if we say it's from men, he's going to say, well, the people are going to stone us. We're afraid of the people. So they came back and said, well, we don't know whence it was. We don't know where it came from. He said, well, then I'm not going to tell you either by what authority I do what I've done. So he just left them there. But then he gave them three stinging denunciations, three stinging indictments or rebukes. He said, let me tell you something. He said, there was a man that had two sons. And then he told them this parable about the sons. The father said to the first son, go and work today in the vineyard. And he said, I'll go, but he didn't go. And then he said, he asked the second one, go and work in the vineyard. He said, I'm not going. But he later repented and went. And then Jesus said, the whores and the tax collectors are going to enter the kingdom before you people. And he pointed right at the scribes and the Pharisees. He said, the harlots and the publicans are going to get into the kingdom of God before you get in there. And then he told them another parable about a man that planted a vineyard and went into the far country. Before he went into the far country, he let it out to tenants. And then he left and went into the far country, sent back men who were representing him to get the proceeds from the vineyard. It says some of them, these men took and beat. They shamefully treated still others of them. And then it says some of them they actually killed. Then Jesus posed the question, what do you think that the king or this man is going to do to these people who so treated these men who were his messengers? And he said, well, he'll come and utterly destroy them. And Jesus said, that's right. And then he quotes this passage of scripture that says that the stone that the builders rejected has become the head of the corner. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. And it says that they began to suspect that he was talking about them. When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parables, they perceived that he was speaking about them. But when they tried to arrest him, they feared the multitude because they held him to be a prophet. But a third thing that Jesus told them, another parable. He told them about a king that made a marriage feast for his son. And he killed the fatted calves and did all this preparation. And he sent out invitations to those who were bidden to come. And they began to make light of it and began to laugh about it. One went off to his business. Another went off to his farm. And they just simply said, oh, we can't come. And it said the rest of them that were left took the messengers who came and gave the invitation. And they actually killed those messengers, put them to death. Jesus said that king will come with his armies. And he's going to destroy those miserable people and burn their city. And then he sent out others to invite the poor and the maimed and the halt and the blind and the poor. And he invited all of these from the highways and the hedges and the back roads. And his guest house was made full. These three stinging denunciations that Jesus Christ brought against these Jewish leaders, the rulers of the religious people. Then a cross-examination began. They summoned enough courage that they began to ask him, tell us, and they did this by stealth. They did it undercover. They said, tell us. You're a good teacher, and you know really how to answer, and you don't regard any man's person. Give us an answer to this question. Should we pay tribute to Caesar or not? Jesus, knowing their hypocrisy, said, show me a piece of your money. They brought him a piece of the money, and he said, whose superscription is on it? They said, Caesar's. And then Jesus uttered that great proverb that has lived for 2,000 years, and I guess has been quoted by more people than perhaps anything else that Jesus said, when he said, then give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and give to God the things that are God's. And then he turned the table on them again and took the initiative on other questions. But whenever the scribes and the Pharisees had been sat down by the Lord on this question, the Sadducees gained some courage, and they came up and said, tell us. And then they told him this story about these seven brothers who in succession married this one woman, each of the men dying without ever leaving any children. And the Levirate marriage code of the Mosaic law required that the next brother was to take the woman and marry her and raise up children to his brother. And they said, all seven men, each married this woman, each died without having left any children. And they built this whole prefabricated, hypothetical situation. And they said, now. And I suspect, had the Lord not known their thoughts, he would have been thinking, yes, what is it you want? Now, where are you? All right, now. They said, now, in the resurrection, whose wife shall she be? And then Jesus had to set them straight, and he simply said, you don't know either the scriptures nor the power of God. And then he began to set them straight on the fact that in the resurrection they're not given in marriage, nor do they marry, but are like angels. Well, that set them down. Then the Pharisees got up again to see if they couldn't figure out a way to stump him. And one of the lawyers of the Pharisees said, tell us, what is the greatest commandment of the law? And Jesus said, how do you read? What do you say? The man said, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. Jesus said, That's right. You do this and you'll live. And then Jesus himself seized the initiative again and began to ask them questions regarding their own law, regarding their own messianic prophecies. He said, What do you think? What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? And they said, Well, he's David's son. And then Jesus said, Well, if he's David's son, how is it that David calls him Lord? And he quoted this prophecy, The Lord said to my Lord, Sit at my right hand till I put thine enemies under thy feet. This was an acknowledged messianic prophecy. And Jesus then said, as he turned them around and twisted them into a knot, he said, Tell me, why is it that David calls Jesus or calls the Christ his Lord if the Christ is David's son? And this was the effect that it had on them. If David thus calls him Lord, how is he his son? And no one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day did anyone dare to ask him any more questions. And then and that ends the 22nd chapter of Matthew. In the 23rd chapter of Matthew, Jesus gives the great seven woes. Six times he calls them Pharisees, scribes, hypocrites. One time he calls them blind guides that strain out gnats and swallow camels, men that overlook the greater matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith, and busy themselves with the tithing of mint, anise, and cumin, and doing things that absolutely have no real value unless they're related to the greater matters of the law. And he pictured them as people who go around straining out gnats and at the same time swallowing great camels, hooves, humps, tail, and all. And he pictures this very ridiculous scene, and no doubt it must have evoked laughter from the people who were the common people, as these people in their black robes, garbed with all their broad phylacteries and their tassels and all that, as they stood there, and Jesus pictured them as gnat strainers and camel swallowers. And then he left the temple after that 23rd chapter, and that's at the end of Tuesday. He goes back to the Mount of Olives. On his way out, after having condemned the city and saying to them, You're not going to see me again. Your house is left to you desolate. You're not going to see me again until you say, Blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. And the disciples must have, or at least perhaps, they got an idea that Jesus Christ was pronouncing a doom upon the city. As they left the city, they went out, and as they were going out toward Bethany again, you have to go over the Mount of Olives to Bethany. You go east, and it's about as far as from here to Kinzit, about 2.5 miles over the Mount of Olives. And they looked back over the city and said, Look at what magnificent buildings. And that's when Jesus sat down. He said, Yes, but I'll tell you, the day is coming. There'll not be one stone left on another that'll not be thrown down. And they said, Well, when is this going to happen? And that's when he told them in the 24th chapter of Matthew, the great destruction of Jerusalem that was coming upon that city. And after he told them of the destruction of Jerusalem, then in chapter 25, he speaks to them of three devastating sins. Number one, the sin of unpreparedness. And he told them the parable of the 10 virgins. He told them of the sin of irresponsibility. And he told them of the parable of the talents and of the man who had the one talent and went and buried it because he was afraid of his Lord. And then he told them also the sin of unconcern and told them of the great judgment scene where the sheep would be on the right hand and the goats on the left, and the difference would be because it would be determined by the fact that these people here had been concerned about the needs of other people and these people had not been concerned about the needs of others. On Wednesday, there's no record of anything that Jesus did as far as we can tell. I suspect he rested. You see, on Tuesday, he had been attacked all day long. And he had been teaching all day long. And I don't doubt but what he was literally exhausted. He went back to Bethany on Tuesday night. I suspect that on Wednesday, he simply rested. Then the next event that we have recorded took place on Thursday morning. Jesus sent Peter and John into the city to make preparation for the feast. They came to him and said, Where are we going to keep the feast? This was a pretty important question because with 2.5 million people in the city, you just couldn't find a vacant lot just everywhere or a house just everywhere. There had to be some provisions made. Jesus said, Go into the city and you'll find a man there carrying a water pitcher. Well, I wonder how they sorted out from all the people that were carrying water, all the men that were carrying it, which man he wanted. Well, there must not have been but one man. The women usually carried the water back there on their heads in these pitchers, and the man carrying the water would have been a very unusual sight, and he said, you're going to see this unusual sight. You follow that man and ask him, the Lord wants to know where the room is that you've prepared for him to keep the feast. And so they followed the man and found him, followed him to his house, and made ready for the feast. This required that they go and purchase a lamb, that they go and have it slaughtered, and on that particular Passover feast of that year, Josephus says that there were 256,500 lambs slain in Jerusalem during that Passover feast. 256,000 lambs. That's a quarter of a million lambs that were slain. That's almost unbelievable. And yet, that's what the record says. Perhaps Josephus stretched it a bit. I don't know. But I do know that John and Peter went and were one of the ones who purchased a lamb, had it inspected by the priests, had the stamp placed upon it as being okay, taken then to the temple, to the altar, where the animal's neck was slit, where the blood was spilled at the base of the altar, and this lamb was then taken and dressed. Its innards and all were kept in it, but it was roasted over a fire. And you can just imagine on that day how many fires there were all over the city of Jerusalem roasting these animals to be eaten that night. And then toward the end of the day, as sundown began to draw the day to a close, Jesus and the 12 disciples made their way into the city of Jerusalem, the last trip that they would make together. And there, having had the supper prepared for them, Jesus and his disciples went into the upper room and they began to eat the supper. And during the supper, as they were eating, he took bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them and said, take, this is my body. And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank of it. And he said to them, this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Truly I say to you, I shall not drink again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God. It was during this time that the disciples were found to be arguing among themselves about who was the greater. Luke records it, Mark doesn't, nor does John. But Luke says that they were arguing about who was the greatest among them. John records the washing of the feet in John the 13th chapter, which I think is a sequel to the argument that Jesus heard them having over who was the greatest among them. Also during this period of time, Judas received the bread with the gravy on it, and Jesus gave to him, and he went out to do his dirty work of betraying him. And John records that it was night. And John then records the great conversation between Jesus and his disciples. It really wasn't a conversation, it was a discourse. Chapters 13 through 17, John records this magnificent bearing of the soul of the Lord and opening of his mind, the bearing of his heart to these men whom he loved and with whom he had been so closely associated over the past 3 1/3 years. And that will be the major part of our study for the next few weeks, because I think that in those statements by the Lord in chapters 13 through 17, I think we find the mind of the Lord opened up. He was under pressure, and I think we see in him there the things that were nearest and dearest to his heart. And from that place, they went out to the Mount of Olives, to the Garden of Gethsemane. And there he sweat as though it were drops of blood, praying 3 times, Father, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. He came back to his disciples each time they were asleep. Jesus woke them up and said, Peter, could you not even watch with me for 1 hour? It was night, it was late, probably 10 or 11 o'clock. And eventually he saw coming, after he had prayed 3 times, he saw coming up through the Kidron Valley, up into the Mount of Olives, to the Garden of Gethsemane. He saw the torch lights of those led by the betrayer, Judas. And there came the men with their swords and their staves and their whatever weapons they had. And they came up with Judas, and they came, and John describes it in the 18th chapter of John. And Jesus went out to meet them after having gained the victory in the garden. Jesus went out to meet them and said, who do you want to see? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. He said, I'm he. They stumbled one against the other like dominoes. They all fell backwards on the ground. Jesus asked them again, who do you want? They said, Jesus of Nazareth. He said, I told you that I am he. If you're looking for me, let these men go. And so Simon Peter, with one last gallant effort, drew his sword and cut off the high priest's servant's ear. The name of the man was Malchus. Jesus then touched the man's ear, restored it to its whole condition, and they then bound him, even in the very presence of that miracle. They bound him as though he were a common criminal, marched him off to Caiaphas, to Annas. They condemned him before the Jewish Sanhedrin with a mock trial, no evidence, no witnesses, no nothing except the fact that they were bent and determined that they were going to kill him. After they had secured from him a confession which was against their law, it was against the law in a matter of capital punishment for any man to have to testify against himself. But the high... And they cast lots to divide his garments. One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other rebuked him, saying, Do you not fear God, since you are under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. And he said, Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom. And he said to him, Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. It was now about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour, while the sun's light failed and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Then Jesus, crying with a loud voice, said, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. Now when the centurion saw what had taken place, he praised God and said, Certainly this man was innocent. And all the multitudes who assembled to see the sight, when they saw what had taken place, they returned home, beating their breasts. And all his acquaintances and the women who had followed him from Galilee stood at a distance and saw these things. A man by the name of Joseph of Arimathea went to Pilate and asked that he might have his body. He, along with Nicodemus, the man that met him by night one night and asked him questions, these two rich men wrapped him in linen, putting upon him the necessary preparations for burial, and they laid him in a new tomb in which no man had ever been laid. And Jesus then was buried by sundown on Friday, according to the law of Moses. And he was in the prison, or in the prison of the tomb, for about 3 days and three nights, according to the figure. But it consists of three figurative days and nights. He was there all day Saturday. But then by Sunday morning, his body was gone. This is a matter of history. I'm not telling you something that can't be substantiated by secular history as well. His body was gone on Sunday morning. What happened to it is a matter of history also, recorded in the texts of the Gospels. We're here tonight because we believe that he was raised from the dead. I've given my life to preaching his name because I believe he was raised from the dead. These are the events of the last few weeks, and in particular the last week of the life of the Lord, in preparation for the discussion of the last 18 hours of the life of the Lord. These events that led up to his death were so much of a burden to the Lord. They were so much a part of his life that he knew that he was born to die, and yet that he would be raised from the dead and give hope to you and me and to those who follow him in every generation. And that's why we've come tonight. The invitation is extended to you tonight for this reason. Jesus lived and died and was buried and was resurrected. In his invitation to you, he asks that you simply do the same thing, that in your life you also die to your old selfishness and your old sinful nature, that you also be buried and be raised to walk a new life of service to him. It's that invitation that we extend to you, and we present to you a living and loving Lord, one who died for you, was raised for your justification. If you would like to serve him for the rest of your life without reservation, would you give yourself to him right now while we stand and sing?
Were you there when they crucified my Lord?